Hey, thanks for spending time with me. Rusnowski here. This is Porchlight. Let me start off our celebration with bad news. Just a few words I'll say about it. The only actual bad news I have is that we can't possibly play all of your favorite Beatles songs in the time we have allotted. But on the broader subject of bad news, it is odd how often people can remember precisely the moment when they became aware of a national tragedy. 9/11, Challenger, Pearl Harbor, way too many assassinations. But they might struggle to place the very first time they saw somebody they wind up spending decades with. Makes some sense, I guess. That type of bad news carries with it the resonance of collective shock and grief, while the exhilarating is almost always more personal. Joy with real meaning can so often be unfamiliar. My sweetheart Tricia claims she never liked any of the Beatles albums the first time she heard them. And that's our heroes for you. Universal, at the same time, deeply personal. And as we know now, eternal. If you were there in January 1964, when I Want to Hold Your Hand exploded out of transistor radios across America, let me amend that. If you had the great fortune to be a young adolescent then, well, you probably remember exactly where you were when that door opened. Care to share? Well, maybe over some coffee sometime. Me? I was sitting in upstate New York on the floor of a second-hand shop lacing up a pair of ice skates. Left foot. Exactly where I was, never forget it. Now, how I felt, just like the music, we ain't got time for all that here.
Oh yeah, I tell you something, I think you'll understand. When I say that something, such a feeling that my love, I can hide. Yeah, you've got that something, I think you'll understand. It's such a feeling that my love, I can hide, I can hide, I can hide.
Oh, do this a turn, should be ideal, man. If we'll meet again, come give me thine.
Come give me thine heart.
There they are. The first two American singles in reverse order of release, with the German version thrown in for good measure. How was the translation? My guest for this party of two, Mark Chilla, is certainly familiar to those of you who listen to WFIU regularly. Mark hosts Afterglow on Friday evenings, where he explores the classic and contemporary American songbook. He presents all manner of found music on Tuesday evening's Ether Game. What you may not know is that this past semester, Mark taught the Jacob Music School's class on the Beatles while the course's founder, Glenn Gass, was on sabbatical. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. How does someone born after December 8, 1980, teach a college-level course on the Beatles? Didn't you have to be there? Well, before Mark explains that through his unique passion and perspective, allow me. Eventually, we all die off and take those passions with us. That would include everyone who saw performances of Shakespeare's Henry VIII at the Globe, Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado at the Savoy, or the premiere of Stravinsky's Firebird in Paris. Those works are still being studied and prized for their unique and significant contributions to our human history. Now, don't you think the music that the Beatles produced is durable enough to be listened to and loved by people who still have never heard it? I do. Mark's students do. And he doesn't even have to convince them of that. All he really does is share what's there.
Well, I'm in my 30s, and my parents are both boomers. They were born in the late 1940s. So growing up, the Beatles were just part of the regular diet of music that I had growing up, alongside Bruce Springsteen and Aretha Franklin and the Big Chill soundtrack and everything. But I remember when I first really got into the Beatles, and I was about 8 or 9, and believe it or not, it wasn't the music that got me into them. It was the lore. I was in the car with my parents and my sister, and a Beatles song came on the radio. I Want to Hold Your Hand, something like that. And it came on, and my parents were singing along, and I remember my sister and I asking about the band, and they just went off and started telling stories about the Beatles, performing on Ed Sullivan and starting the British invasion, and the story about Paul McCartney supposedly dying and leaving clues in all of their records. And as a 9-year-old, that was all fascinating to me. And it was after that moment that I found my parents' Beatles records. They had since put the record player away in the basement. And I went to the basement and grabbed the record player, brought it back upstairs, plugged it in, and started listening to them over and over and over again after school. The U.S. Capitol release of Revolver and Rubber Soul, and they had the Blue and the Red albums, those greatest hits albums from the 1970s. One of the records that they did not have was Abbey Road. And the reason that my dad did not have it in his current collection is he said that he listened to that record so much that he wore the grooves down. It was then that the music was more important to me than the lore. I spent so much time with them. They were my four best friends for a long time. I mean, they were my Lord of the Rings. They were my comic books.
Did you find yourself having different favorites or being influenced by albums differently than your parents were?
I think so, because my parents, they experienced it as it unfolded. And for me, it was the process of discovery. And also my perspective was different because very soon after I discovered them, my experience with them was as a budding musician. When I was 10, I got my first guitar. But my very first guitar teacher was this guy named Gerard. I remember he wore like rainbow-colored socks with his Birkenstock sandals. And I only took lessons with him for probably about maybe 6 months at the most. All I wanted to do was learn how to play Beatles songs. And I think this sort of impressed him that this 10-year-old kid wants to learn Beatles songs. He moved out of town, but as a parting gift before he moved out of town, he gave me one of the best gifts I've ever received to this day, which was the complete piano, vocal, guitar scores to all of the Beatles songs. And I still have those books today.
Let's talk a little bit about the Beatles from your perspective. Looking at it from the remove that you have, it's been 50 years since Abbey Road.
Yeah.
If you were meeting a complete stranger who had no sense of the Beatles, how would you describe them?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's a tough question. I mean, what they did in the 1960s was they synthesized a lot of different musical traditions. They took the idioms of rock and roll and applied more traditional songwriting techniques to them. And they were a unit not led by one person in particular. For many, many years, finding a guitar, finding a bass, finding a drummer, and forming a band, that sort of started with the Beatles.
One of the things that impressed me about the Beatles, I think it did everyone, was how different the personalities were.
Mm-hmm.
You could sense that through the music, but also there was just an aura about each of the Beatles. The girls in our class all had favorites, and you could tell a lot about a girl by who her favorite Beatle was. All of those things together just gave you a sense that this was a place you could occupy because it was diverse. And in any diverse environment, there's going to be a lot of discovery. Could you just talk a little bit about how each of these individuals struck you when you started to discover the Beatles?
I noticed that they all had very distinct personalities, but I was really only drawn to one of them, and that was Paul McCartney. He was my guy. Still to this day, want to be Paul McCartney. Every detail of his life and his music was what I really gravitated towards. And that's, I think everyone had that experience. They had a favorite and they attached themselves to that. And discovering the Beatles in the early to mid 1990s was almost a perfect time to do it because this was the time of the Beatles anthology coming out. So the Beatles anthology was a television event when I was watching a lot of television as a kid. And these albums came out at a time when I'm discovering music. I bought those anthology albums the day they all came out. It was like me and a guy my dad's age waiting in line at the record store to get these albums. The demo versions of certain songs are as prominent in my mind as the fully complete pieces.
How did the movie A Hard Day's Night impact you?
It wasn't until years later, I was in college when I finally sat down and watched the whole thing. Because when I was a kid, it didn't really appeal to me. Black and white, I didn't get the jokes, it was very British. But what did appeal to me was Help. It was in color, it was funnier, there was exotic locale. So when I was, you know, 11, I thought Help was the cool movie. And it wasn't until years later when I got a little bit older and watched both of those again, Hard Day's Night, those are where the good jokes are. But as a kid, you see a black and white movie and you kind of tune it out a little bit. So that's where my experience coming from a kid in the 90s listening to the Beatles is a bit different, because you watch A Hard Day's Night, it just feels like an old movie.
I want to ask you about one of the greatest strengths of the Beatles. You're looking at the work that everybody mentions in the first paragraph. And then you're also looking at the second, third, and fourth paragraphs. A song or an album that, oh yeah, I remember that song, but it wouldn't be my first choice. Could you talk about their second shelf stuff? Songs like Rain or I'll Follow the Sun, the stuff that was either on B-sides or album cuts.
It's funny when I think about some of their deeper cuts, their entire catalog of 160 odd songs, they were all singles to me. And I think it's even more pronounced today. This past semester, I taught the Beatles course, and I had the distinct pleasure and privilege of teaching that course to a group of college-age students. And there were songs that they knew that are really, really, really deep cuts. There's this one student who just loved the song What You're Doing, which is like a deep cut off of – is that on Beatles for Sale or is that on with
– It is. Which is – Beatles 65.
Yeah, yeah. But it's just like – it's a goofy little Paul McCartney song that I never even thought of. But for whatever reason, this one student loved that song so much. Another example of this, if you go on Spotify and look at the Beatles, the number one most played Beatles song is Here Comes the Sun. Even though Come Together and Something were the two singles from Abbey Road. There is also this newfound obsession with the song Hey Bulldog, you know, which is one of the songs from the Yellow Submarine album. A lot of jazz players like this song. A lot of my students love this song. But even when I was growing up, that song was really, really, really rare. As a person who's collecting Beatles albums, that's the last one you buy. But now that all the entire Beatles collection's on Spotify, it doesn't matter where they are, you can listen to anything. But it's funny, the Beatles are a band that keep getting reintroduced to society every several years. So when I was growing up, the Beatles anthology had just come out, because that was sort of peak boomer nostalgia season in the early 1990s. And for my students, a lot of them were around the age that I was when I discovered the Beatles in 2009. And 2009 is an interesting time for the Beatles, because that was not only the time that all of the new mono and stereo remasters came out, but it was also when the Beatles Rock Band came out, which was a video game that was available on all different kinds of platforms. Do you know the game Rock Band at all?
I don't.
It's this fun little video game where your controller is like this plastic guitar or a plastic drum set, and the notes sort of scroll by vertically on the screen, and you have to press the button to play the right note at the right time. But you get to play along with your favorite songs. So you could play Paul McCartney's bass line. And when my students this past semester were 11, 12 years old, and they had their Xbox or their PlayStation in the basement, they would buy Beatles Rock Band, because it was one of the biggest selling games of that year. So their discovery of the Beatles was different than mine and different than everybody's.
Little darling, it feels like years since it's been here. four drums. That's all Ringo Starr needed.
Ringo was the king of feel.
He's a song drummer.
Let me tell you about Wendley House at the University of Michigan. There were four floors in Wendley House. There was one phone on each floor. There was a house mother. Down in the basement, there was the one television set. It was on one end of a large room. On the other end was the ping pong table. In February of 1964, about 25 of us were gathered, I think, for that first visit by the Beatles. I'd been walking around campus singing I Want to Hold Your Hand, thinking about a girl who was at Vassar. We were sitting there watching this plane come in and just waiting. And then these guys got off. We'd seen pictures. We weren't shocked that, you know, their hair was, gosh. And we said, okay. But there was a feeling and a certain kinship among those of us who kind of recognized one another. Yeah, we saw him get off the plane. That was the Beatles.
Hey, nice to be with you. You're listening to Porchlight with Tom Rusnowski. Production support for this program comes from Smithville at smithville.com and from Gilbert Construction, remodeling homes since 1994.
So I go by my ear, what I hear. That's why I buy records. Like the Beatles, ain't no record gonna top Hard Day's Night in my library, in my house. So that's my record.
Can't buy me love. Money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got, I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love.
For this postcard home, the postmark reads Indianapolis, Indiana. If there was a particular event that happened over 50 miles away and over 50 years ago, and it had drawn an estimated crowd of nearly 30,000 people, how would you rate your chances of actually knowing someone alive today who was there? Let me add that the overwhelming majority of those in attendance that evening were adolescent girls, so that increases the odds somewhat. Also, let me assure you that it would not be an event you'd either forget or regret, however your life turned out. For most of us, it would be a story worth crafting for the occasional retelling, and it might even rate a mention in your obit someday. Thursday evening, September 3rd, 1964, the State Fair Coliseum and Grandstand in Indianapolis, Indiana. You are there. Sort of.
On behalf of all of the State Fair Board and all the good guys from WIFE, may I present the Beatles!
Box seats, $4. Did you save your ticket stub? Did you possibly steal that handsome hat show print poster from a telephone pole? Even the available merch sold that night would likely get a second look on Antiques Roadshow. But why would you ever sell the proof that you were actually there? I do know someone who was promised tickets, only to discover that evening that her soon-to-be former friend had given them to her older sister. That name was remembered forever, at least. And it still makes for a pretty good story.
My first exposure to the Beatles was February 9th, 1964, on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was in fourth grade. These four handsome lads with their cute British accents and their really cool electric guitars. And it was like, oh man, I got to do this. You know, and I grew up in a very musical family. You know, my dad played tenor sax. My brother was a drummer. My sister played piano. My dad got me this secondhand beat-up guitar, and it was missing a string, and I was off to the races, man. I wanted to be George Harrison. When my kids were little and I would introduce them to the Beatles, they would say, "Dad, you were there. You and Mom were there. What was that like?" And I would say, "Oh, man, it was like every night at 10 o'clock, you know, I grew up in the Chicago area, and we had WLS, AM radio. And every evening they would play the top three songs, and I would lay there in bed with my little clock radio on the nightstand, and always one of those three songs was a Beatles song, and often two of them were Beatles songs, and every once in a while, all three of them. It was just a time like no other. I'd love to be a kid again and go through that."
To me, you know she's happy as can be, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. Baby says she's mine, you know she tells me all the time, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl.
I saw the Beatles and on TV, and they were the first people I ever saw, ever, that looked happy.
Just look into my eyes, I'll be there to make you feel right. If you're feeling sorry and sad, I'd really sympathize. Don't you be sad, just call me tonight. The sun has faded away,
I'll try to make it shine. There is nothing I won't do. When you need a shoulder to cry on, I hope it will be mine. Call me tonight and I'll come to you.
Endeavor here on Porch Light, a segment we'll call Wax Poetic to commemorate the accomplished works of original material that have appeared on vinyl over the years. The very first album you bought, the first album that transported you somewhere else, oh, I bet you remember, and you still have a copy, don't you? Our first guest, the aforementioned Professor Glenn Gass.
The best Beatle album, I mean, at a certain point, it's the one you're listening to now. And you could make a case for almost any of their albums, if you really had to. There was a Rolling Stone magazine did a top 500 albums of all time. And okay, Sgt. Pepper, nothing else can be number one. Doesn't mean it's the best, but it's the most important. So you've got to give it that. But you can't say Sgt. Pepper number one without immediately saying Pet Sounds number two, because no Pet Sounds, no Sgt. Pepper, Brian Wilson's masterpiece. And the number three was Revolver, because all the critics go, okay, we got the two ones we have to say out of the way. Let's get the one we really want. It's Revolver. The 66 was such a great year anyway, when you got Blonde on Blonde coming out, and Pet Sounds, and Aftermath, and the birds are doing 8 miles high, and it just seems like rock is on fire. You know, it's not perfect, but it is. It's because it's the Beatles. But for them, it's just the next album they're recording before, oops, got to go on the road, got to get this done. They're not thinking of themselves as making a masterpiece. They're just making their next album. It doesn't have the same warm, fuzzy glow of Rubber Soul or Abbey Road or Meet the Beatles. What it still has, to me anyway, and I think a lot of people, is that just the glow of just utter astonishment. Like, you just still can't believe what you're hearing. At a certain point, it's like, yeah, it's 1966 or last week or whatever. This is still shockingly adventurous. Rubber Soul set them free to say, okay, sitar, why not? Sped up piano into my life, why not? So all of a sudden the studio's up for grabs now. We can actually make it a record that cannot be reproduced live and have that not even be an issue. So I think that freed them up in terms of how the productions and arrangements could come to life. You know, Rubber Soul feels like a real piece. I'm Looking Through You, and Girl, and You Won't See Me, and Norwegian Wood. They seem like they come from the same place. In Revolver, you got John and Paul. They're completely different. Paul's doing his classical thing, the Bach of pop music, doing Eleanor Rigby and For No One, you know, with the French horn and the clavichord, and Good Day Sunshine, the vaudeville, and Got to Get Into My Life with the horns. And he's really just experimenting with how many different styles and colors and instruments he can use and make them work in a pop song. Eleanor Rigby, come on, with a string octet and incredibly literate lyrics, and that's a single? That was a single on the radio. John, completely different. He's going into the saturated, guitar-drenched psychedelia. And Andrew Bergen sing Dr. Robert. George gets three songs on Revolver. I Want to Tell You, Taxman, Love You Too, which is more than he got on any other Beatle album. It's almost like it slipped their attention. Wait a minute, George, you got three. Next album, you get one, because he gets one on Sgt. Pepper. It's not a singer-songwriter album, really, but it sort of feels like it. The first album where you got, these are John songs, and these are Paul songs, and then you got the wild card of George thrown in. But for some reason, they don't feel jagged or out of place with each other, because, again, that sort of the ambition of the album is so high, and then so are they. It just feels like, yeah, you're on this sort of journey through this album, and on whatever comes next, you'll take it, because it's the Beatles, and it will work, and it did.
Turn off your
Okay, The Beatles by John Bailey. I can't remember life without them. My parents were absolutely of that generation. They were in 10th grade when The Beatles went on Sullivan, conquered America. They bought all the albums. We had this cheapo Magnavox turntable in the living room. And I remember Let It Be. At the beginning of Two of Us, there's a voice that says, "I Dig a Pygmy" by Charles Hawtrey on the Deaf Aids. And you hear a ha 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 in the background. Phase one in which Doris gets her oats. I thought that was my dad's voice and his laughter. December 8th, 1980, John Lennon was shot late on a Monday night. It was after I'd gone to bed, but I got word of it the next day. And that evening, at 5:30, my family did something that we never did. We all gathered around the TV and watched the network nightly news. And I remember seeing scenes of this apartment building in New York surrounded by thousands of people in the streets, singing, chanting, holding signs, close-ups of people crying. And I was facing the TV, my back was to the rest of my family, and I heard my mother make a noise, and I turned around, and there she was, sitting in a chair, and the corners of her mouth had turned up, as if she was breaking into the broadest grin I had ever seen. And it was actually her face contorted in pain, and tears began to stream down her cheeks, and that's how much my parents felt about the Beatles, and it got passed on to me.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom
let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be. 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 Whisper words of wisdom. Let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer. Let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer. Let it be.
Talking about the Beatles, John, Paul, George, and Ringo just yesterday. In fact, Solveig and I were doing our fairly regular exercise of asking one another, okay, which Beatle are you? And this is a kid born in 2003, and we still have conversations like this, like on a regular basis. I don't know. How do you have a Beatles freak who's 16 years old in 2019? Her Spotify playlists are full of Beatles. She says she hopes that she's a Paul. And I said, well, I do too. She said, Mom, you're more of a John. And I said, I like to think I'm more of a Paul with some George thrown in. And she's like, Mom, you're a John. I said, he's so cynical and jaundiced, though. And she said, yeah.
Many individuals to thank for this Beatles episode, proving once again that All Together Now was more than just a song title. Appropriately, a diverse collection of folks and their experiences over time. Mark Chilla, George Walker, George Thorogood, Mike Pascash, Glenn Gass, John Bailey, Yael Cassander, and Louis Armstrong. So, last show. First season. I'm going to click off the light and just sit here in the dark and contemplate for a bit. The parting word, along with the last song, written and sung a little over 50 years ago. All these creative, courageous souls we meet along the way, novelists, career athletes, the deeply devout, they cast themselves forward without the slightest thought about why they ever did it. Over time, damage and sorrow are created as well. They accompany that first pure intention, finding unbounded joy and proving that it just may be possible in this life, on this earth. Joy always needs to be precious, just not so damn scarce. Celebrate in the face of all this cruelty? Times like these can make that hard to fathom. So I'm still listening, fellas, and I'm still searching. For all that's happened in this world since, you're still here with me. This poem from June 5th, 1968. The Beatles were in London that day, mixing the White Album. Quote, "My telephone rang in the middle of the night, but I didn't answer it. It rang and rang and rang and shut up and rang as if it were possessed. I always figure that good news doesn't travel in the middle of the night. So I didn't answer the telephone. I let it go to hell. I was right, too. It was someone calling to tell me Kennedy had been hit. Richard Brautigan. Thank you, boys. And so, next time."
Don't smoke.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
Production support for Porch Light with Tom Rusnowski comes from Smithville. Fiber internet, streaming TV, home security and automation in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Gilbert Construction, specializing in restoring, remodeling, and revitalizing Bloomington-area homes since 1994. More information about Gilbert Construction by calling 812-876-8110 or on the web at gilbertbuilt.us. Porchlight is engineered by our radio audio director, Mike Pascash. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Visit us at wfiu.org/porchlight.